right. It's what I promised. Michael Jackson's in the building. That's right. He was fascinated by medieval history, and but you didn't start out in history, did you, Michael?
No, I was far too bright to think it was a good idea to go out and try to write books, because it's next to impossible to earn a living like that. So I thought from a very early age, I'm going to do something where I'm paid a lot of money, because I was a callow brat, and I decided I was going to be an actuary. You know what an actuary is?
You tell when people are going to die.
That's right. It's somebody who finds accountancy too exciting. And I managed to successfully fail every exam I took as an actuary 2 years. And after that, I thought, oh, I've got to do something else. So I had a brother who was an IBM salesman at the time. I thought, this is great, because he gets a free car, free petrol, he gets his holidays paid for, he gets everything. I thought, I could do that. So I wrote to IBM, and they were very polite. They said, nope. But I wrote to some other people, and they said yes. Yeah. So I spent 5 years working at a computer company called Wordplex in England. That was nice. Then I went to Wang Laboratories, based over in Lowell. That was great. I spent 5 years there. I spent 1 year at an IBM software house called Bluebird. That was their biggest software house. And there's a consistency here. Wordplex went bust. Wang Labs went bust. Bluebird Software went bust. And then I had a few more jobs, and after 13 years, I did a count up, and I found I'd done 13 jobs, because they all owed me money. And I thought, I'm fed up with this. I've got to try something different. So what else can I do? I thought, well, I've got no qualifications. Nobody in the computer industry would hire me, because they know their firm would go bust. So I thought, I like reading, I'll try writing something. And that was it.
I once had a girl say that she wouldn't go to work for us. She wanted to work for a big company because she was afraid that if she worked for a small company like us, she could ruin us. We thanked her in advance.
Nice.
Thank you for not going to work for us. I'm sure when people saw your record, Michael, they said, oh, my God, we made another bummer here.
Several of my friends thought I misspelled my name because it should have been J-I-N-X, but
Jinx, yeah.
they took a great interest in my career, though. A very good reason, because they wanted to know where to sell shares just in case I joined the firm.
Please let me know as soon as you get a job there. Well, you know, I guess we should tell people where you're from. I mean, I don't know if anybody's gotten the idea yet, but where are you from, Michael?
Well, oddly enough, I'm from England.
England?
I'm not local.
You're not welcome?
No, I know I sound as though I am. Because I've spent nearly a week in the States now, so I sound like an American.
That's right, and you've probably been practicing that southern dialect, right?
Yeah, can you tell?
Yes, I can.
I live out in Doherty Moor, down in the far west country of England. It's lovely there, my lovely.
And I understand you have a couple of dogs.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's only one now, sadly. Got a gorgeous Ridgeback, my old pooch. Who's now currently missing me very badly when we do FaceTime, when I've been FaceTiming my family. The dog have started whining in the background because she can hear me, but she can't see me. She doesn't know what's going on. But I did have a Bernese Mountain dog too, but she sadly died a couple of years ago. Ate too many acorns in the winter, I'm afraid, and it gave her a twisted gut.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
You know, the president of Fuji here has one of those dogs.
Bernese?
Yes, he does.
Oh, he sounds like a nice guy.
He is a nice guy. It's an awfully big dog to have right here.
Well, they're weird things because the breed nearly died out in about 1900. And there was a mad Swiss professor who decided that the colouring of the breed shouldn't die out because, you know, they're very, very colour specific. They've got brown eyebrows, white muzzle, brown cheeks. They've got a white cross on the chest. They've got brown shoulders. They're very, very specific colours. And he decided that the breed was dying out too fast. So he implemented a plan to rescue them, which meant that any dog that didn't have the right colours was put down at birth. Not
well,
very good.
Right.
But the other thing he did was he crossbred them with Newfoundlands. So some of the dogs now you get a Newfoundland-type size, and other ones are more sort of collie sheepdog-type size because that's what the original dogs were like.
Wow.
Now, I tend to get the smaller ones because my house isn't that big. Yeah. But, yeah, I can understand the ones who like the big version.
Well, the president of Fuji and his wife are not very tall people, and they have this big dog leading them.
We call it a bear.
Yeah, there it's a bear. You're right. It's pretty funny to see him walking around.
They're great dogs.
Yeah. So, Now, I'm just curious, because you got into writing, you just decided,
yep.
Well, I think I'll just do that. I haven't succeeded at computer sales, and actuary was not a success. How does one make that jump? I'm just not quite sure.
Well, it was easier for me. I mean, the trouble is that most writers decide they're going to be writers while they're at school or college, and they never have the discipline of going to work, which is a big problem. I mean, it's hard enough for someone who's not had any life experiences to try to write anyway. I think in my case, I was quite lucky because I'd had a good career in selling computers. The only trouble was that all the firms I worked for didn't have such a good manner of continuing. But I was fortunate that I had the natural discipline that I wanted to make a go of it. So my first rule was that I wanted to make sure I could write a book, because I don't know if you know, but so many people are convinced they can write that for every book that's started, less than 1% will ever be finished in terms of writing.
Wow.
And that's because modern life is busy, and you know, you can be sitting down and the next copy of, in England, it would be Coronation Street or EastEnders comes on, and you immediately stop what you're doing and think, I'll just take a half-hour break, watch a bit of TV, and half an hour turns into an hour, and that turns into the rest of the night. You think, hell, okay, I'll start it tomorrow. And that's how most people's lives go. I was very lucky. We were so broke that we couldn't afford a TV. We had to get rid of it. And yeah, it's amazing how concentrated you can be without a television in the background.
Absolutely.
But I was working at 6 o'clock in the morning through till 11:30 at night. And I'd take a half hour out for lunch, but that was pretty much it. That was my working day, 7 days a week. So I wanted to make sure I could finish a book. I wrote one book in January.
One book in January?
Yeah, it was 120,000 words. And then at the beginning of February, I thought, well, I've got to do something else now. What will I do? I wrote a book on how to find yourself a job if you find yourself unemployed. I had experience of that. And then the third book was beginning of March. I thought, I've got to do something else now. I'll write a crime book.
And were people reading these books? Were you getting them published, writing them?
I was writing them. It was 3 months. Even then, it took time to get the books published. But the first book was accepted over the phone by Bantam Press in England. Lovely editor called Brew Doherty, who rejected the thing 3 days later in writing. And the reason was that the book was modern-day thriller, all about bombs and bullets and sex and drugs and all the good stuff that you expect. The trouble was, it was all about the IRA, and they'd just agreed the first ceasefire.
A little outdated, Michael.
Yeah, just out of date by 2 days. If we'd got the book tour 2 days earlier, I'd have had a contract, and my whole career would have been different. And then the second book was all about getting yourself a job when you're out of work, and my agent refused to take that. I said, why? And she said, it's libelous. I said, nah, it's not. She said, yes, it is, and you're libeling IBM. I'm not going to have that. I said, well, I never worked for IBM. It can't have anything to do with them. She said, yes, it is. And it was only 4 years later she admitted to me her husband was an IBMer, and he had just left her 2 weeks before for an IBM SE. And if there was anything she was not going to do, it was going to publish a book about how to help anybody in the computer industry get a job.
So there was a personal vendetta going on there.
Absolutely. So, yeah. A vicious one, actually.
Wow. So then, what was your first book that was published?
The third book I wrote, the crime thriller, was all about the Knights Templar and their end and how they got disbanded. Because I'd spent the previous few weeks reading a book called Dungeon Fire and Sword by an American historian, John J. Robinson. It was all about the Templars. Really fascinating history, and I'd recommend that to anybody who's got an interest in the Templars. And I read that, and one of the things that came through was, after the Templars were disbanded, a whole load of them went missing. They didn't all get killed. They didn't all get arrested and thrown into the Benedictines or the Cistercians. A huge number just disappeared, and no one knows what happened to them, except that quite a lot of them joined the Teutonic Knights. Quite a few went to the Portuguese orders, and some went to the Spanish orders. So I thought, that's interesting. And I happened to be in Devon at the time, and I was wandering around. I found this manor, Thurston Manor, where the first Thurston, it's still owned by the same family now, it's the longest period of ownership of any manor in England, but the first one turned up in 1285. And I thought, that's interesting, because no one knows where he came from. If he had turned up in 1314, he could have been a Templar, and no one would have guessed. I thought, oh, that's an interesting idea. I thought, yeah, it's a start point for a book. That was very interesting, so I just carried on with that. And now I've written 32 books in that series.
Where they say that more than 11 is just too much. Right?
I read that. I was sitting on a panel with a good buddy of mine, Phil Gooden, and we were asked this sensible question about, is there a natural end to a crime series? And he says, oh, yes, yes. You couldn't possibly go beyond about 9 books because, you know, after 8-9 books, you get a bit jaded. And if you get to 11, then really you're just dragging the bottom of the... And I said, oi. He said, what? I said, I've just written 21. He said, oh, apart from...
Exactly.
It depends. I mean, the main thing is, if you're writing... There are certain authors where you can say that they write one book many, many times and change the names. But what I do is I write lots of different types of book, lots of different genres of book, but they're all hooked by two main characters. So I write love stories. I mean, Leopard's Return was the one my agent said was my first love story. I write humorous books. I write really black, dark books. I can write any sort of style I want, but because it's all...
Whoa, okay, Gracie. Taking the microphone.
That was a dog taking my microphone. But because I write basically with the same characters, it means I've got much more flexibility. I can move around and I can play. I think it's very easy to get hung up on the idea that writers can only write one style. And if they want to write different styles, they have to invent different names for themselves or invent different genres that they can write in. I like the fact that within crime, you're actually very open. You can take almost any aspect of life you want.
And by doing that, you have maintained this huge list of books.
I thought you were going to say maintained a huge mortgage, because I have.
A huge mortgage? Well, okay. That keeps you motivated on writing, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That's the main motivation. I look at the bank balance, cry slightly, and then start writing quick.
How long does it take you to write a book?
Short answer, to write a book is about 2.5 months. 140,000 to 160,000 words. That's the short answer. The truth is it's taken about 30 years because there's 30 years of research behind it, which allows me to go straight back into that period and be able to write about it because I have been studying it intensively for many years. But then that's only writing, and no book involves one quick write.
Exactly.
Writing is all rewriting. Editing, and so it takes generally, I would say, about 6 to 9 months solid of writing the book first, editing it, because I'll go through and edit it about 20, 30 times, because I'm editing while I'm going through it, and then I'll go through two major edits when I've finished as well. When I've done that, it goes to the editor, it comes back with her comments, I've got to amend it to suit what she thinks is right, as long as I agree with her. She sends it away, I get the copy edit back from the copy editor, and then I've got to go through line by line and agree every change that she's made to every sentence. Then it goes away, then it comes back from the proofers, and I've got to go through the proofs as well. So, yeah, yes, it takes 2.5 months to write a book, but that's just the start.
Exactly. I was looking at something you had written here. It said, my books aren't just about kings and the great and the good, though. They're based about real people in dreadful times, and they're actually based on real events. I research exclusively court records, the coroner's rolls, and it says when people were predicting dire times ahead, talking about the famine, war, and plague, and it all came true within 50 years,
yep.
I just wonder, do you think you're in that time period right now?
Well, I can honestly tell you I'm slightly better dressed than I would have been back in those days. Right, the nice thing is it's like you talk to anybody who believes in reincarnation.
Yes.
And whenever you
do you
talk
believe
to
in reincarnation?
Nah.
Okay, I just wanted to say that. Okay.
I've got a number of... I've got some friends who are shamans, and both North American Indian shamans and in the UK as well. And so I've got a leaning towards their beliefs because I've also taken up dowsing recently, and I've discovered that I can douse. And if you can douse for water, then you can douse for energy fields. And then that does make you have to reconsider all of, because I'm basically a scientist by training, and I did not believe any of this. It was another scientist who said, you've got to try this, Mike, because it works for me, and I don't know why. And the only reason seems to be possibly getting into modern physics, basically, with the modern different strains. But anyway, yes, that's not, I don't really believe in reincarnation. But the interesting thing about reincarnation, the people who believe in it,
yes.
If you ever speak to someone who believes in reincarnation, always, always, they are a reincarnation of a king of Egypt, Napoleon, the Duke of Wellington, a king or a queen. They are never the poor, scruffy, tatty little Herbert who lived down the street and cleared dung out of the gutters. And I know, if I was reincarnated, that would have been me.
So I don't want it. Okay.
I'd have been the one covered in the brown stuff that wasn't nice mud.
Okay. Well, you know, I just found it interesting because we're predicting dire times and famine and war and plague, and here we are in the 2014.
As a writer, you want to write about things that are horrible because writing about really nice, happy times is boring as hell. Reading about nice, happy times is boring. You want challenges for people. You want people to overcome horrible obstacles. You want real difficult times for people. And the time I'm writing about, the Templars had just been disbanded. Christianity had lost the Holy Land. They did not think God was very happy with them, for understandable reasons. The Pope had just been discovered to have murdered the previous Pope. This was not good times for Christianity. And so people were saying, yeah, okay, well, the year 1300, that's going to be the start of the end of all time, and the world's going to end. And so they said there'll be famine, there'll be war, there'll be plague. 1316 through to 1322 was the start of the Great European Famine, killed off probably up to about 30% of the entire population of Europe. In 1 month, in Ypres, in Belgium, 10% of the population died. That was June 1316. 10% of the population died of starvation because of the famine. And the famine went on till 1322.
They didn't have food stamps back then.
No. they did to an extent. The church was very good. The church made sure that a huge amount of food was given out to the poor. But there were so many people starving they couldn't support it. The social service systems at the time just could not support that sort of problem. So you had the famine. You had lots of people dislocated. They were leaving their homes because they couldn't find anything to eat. And so they started trundling off around the countryside, joining club gangs, as they were called, the Trail Bastons. And they would beat up and kill anybody they could just to steal their money or their food. And that led on to, because of all the unrest, that led on to barons taking up arms against the king because they could, because the whole of the legal system was falling apart. So you had civil wars, which led up to the Hundred Years' War, which was a pretty major event for Europe. And then, of course, immediately after the Hundred Years' War started, 2 years after, there was the Black Death, the plague. So you had famine, war, disease. It was beautiful. It all came to pass within 50 years.
And you've chosen that period as your most favorite period to write about.
Yeah,
exactly. And you're making money off of it.
Yes.
Yes.
Look, crime does pay.
Exactly, exactly. Well, we are talking here with Michael Jex. He is the master of medieval murder mystery. Now, I've got to say, when you say medieval, I didn't do very well in medieval history when I was in college. And I actually look back at life now and I say, you know, I should have paid attention more in history class. And particularly in the job I do now, you know, I'm always feel I'm at a very big disadvantage because I didn't like history and I didn't learn it, and now I'm always trying to catch up. When you were growing up, what were your favorite subjects in school?
Oh, maths, physics, chemistry.
Yeah. Not history.
I liked art. I loved reading about history out of school, but I hated the way it was taught. It was boring as hell. Absolutely boring.
Well, maybe that was my problem.
I'm sorry. That's the problem, I think, with saving the presence of an ex-teacher here, but that is the problem with an awful lot of teachers and schools. But then it's not necessarily the teacher's fault. It's the way the curriculums are set up. And if in England we've got a national curriculum, which seemed like a really good idea when they brought it in, because it meant that you could gauge everybody on the same standards. Nah, doesn't work.
We're going through that with the core standards right now here in the United States.
Lord,
yep,
oh,
exactly.
You have my sympathy.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. It just does not work. What you want is inspiring teachers who can enthuse their students. I was enormously lucky. I had a fantastic set of math teachers who managed their students by sheer terror, really. But they were really, they succeeded. Yeah.
Well, that was back in the day when you could do that, Michael.
That was back in the day when they had the cane.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
It worked. Yeah. I got caned twice. Once was justified.
Well, listen, but, you are going to be here at the Lander this afternoon at 4:30.
That's right.
What brought you to Greenwood? I mean, you know, we're kind of out of the way, and here you are. You've been down in Louisiana. You're on a book tour. You're going to be in Greenville on Thursday, I think it is. How did you end up here at Lander?
Well, mainly because of the lady sitting to my right, Connie Edwards.
Yes.
We've been communicating via email for about 12 years now, and about 8 years
platonic,
ago...
Platonic, I hope.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
Just
well, it's difficult not to be over... the thought of an electrical... No, it's not nice.
Okay.
I'm not going to go further.
All right, we
but,
had that answered.
We had chats for a long time, didn't we? And then finally, I used to come over every year or so to go to the Bouchercon conferences, which are for crime writers, and that was all fun. And then 1 year, it was just at the same time as the Ball State University was having their, and it was called, I've forgotten, Magna Cum Murder, I think it was. And so we were going to meet up there. It was a great, brilliant idea. So I flew out to Ball State, and I had a phone call the same night I got there saying, my car's broken. So this is actually the first, I've met Connie at last for the first time yesterday.
Well, how about that? That's terrific.
But that's why Connie's done all the organizing behind this. It's brilliant.
It is.
All authors are really happy to be allowed out.
Because
most of the time we're nailed to a desk. And can I get up now? Nah, write a book. All right.
Okay, there you go.
But it's just brilliant to be invited to come away. And it's lovely to come to a university, because I actually work at a university in England with Exeter University, helping students who find it difficult to write their dissertations or essays or anything else.
If you had to give it in one sentence, what is the best piece of advice you can give out to a writer, to somebody that wants to be a writer or who is writing?
Write. That's it. Just write.
Right.
Don't go to creative writing classes. Don't go and find the best self-help book on how to write. Sit down and write. Anything else is prevarication. The most important thing is, if you can, chuck away the TV, sit down, bit of paper and a pen if you need to, but just write. Because it's the only way you can learn your style and how you want to write.
Now, you have just done a new book. You have a new book out. What's the name of that book?
That's going to be Fields of Glory. The latest book, this is a bit difficult because there's always a new one coming out, but the last book is the paperback of the book that came out last year,
okay,
which is Templar's Acre, which is all about the Siege of Acre and the end of the Kingdom of Jerusalem.
Yes.
Good dog in the background there, you'll notice.
Yes. Great.
then...
Okay. Okay, Gracie, let's quiet down.
And then I've also got, in June, there's going to be Fields of Glory, which is a war book purely and simply about the first major battle of the Hundred Years' War, where the British Army went over to France for 2 weeks, basically expecting to have a nice little quick raid, steal some cattle and come home. And then, unfortunately, they had this slight accident. They met the whole of the French army, which is a bit embarrassing. But it's a good, fun story.
A good, fun story. Hey, listen, Michael, it has been an absolute blast to have you here today. If you'd like to hear more about Michael Jackson, listen to him talk. You know how he talks. Then you need to be over at Lander this afternoon at 4:30. I think it's
room 200.
Room 200.
Right. And it's free to the public.
Right. And it is free to the public. It is room 200 over there at Lander.
Learning
Center. The Carnell Learning Center, correct? That's right. So make sure you make your way over there. It'll be a blast to be there. I have one more question to ask you. It says you're a founder of Tyners Morris, and you've discovered the undeveloped delight in dancing mixed with strong ales.
Yes. But don't you find that most things in life are a lot happier if you've got strong ale?
Yes. And you're a brewmaster too, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You like to brew your own?
I certainly do. And I like to drink it afterwards.
Well, this has been short and sweet. It certainly has been a blast. Michael Jex, you are going to be here at Lander this afternoon at 4:30 to room 200 at the Carnell Learning Center. And then on Thursday, is it Thursday you're going to be at Barnes & Noble? Okay, because I had seen it on your list here. But you have a website?
Yep.
What's the website?
www.michaeljecks.co.uk.
That's right. And you also send out a newsletter.
Yeah.
You're very active in the writing end of things, aren't you?
It sort of goes with the territory.
Yes. Well, listen, thanks so much for stopping by here. We really appreciate it.
Thanks
what a way to
time.
Start the morning. there you go.
Thanks very much.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody. We'll join the news, and then Laura Ingram will be on. Bye-bye, everybody.